Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me for another very special episode, the sister knight to my mirror guy, it's Court. Hey, Court.
Hey, Scott.
Oh, it's been a long night to get to this.
It's been an adventure.
Yeah, not a fun one. just to fill in the listeners, once again, for 2 weeks running, I've had serious, weird, inexplicable internet connection issues that I initially blame on Skype, and then we discover that it's not Skype, it's you. And you know, everything from starting and rebooting and restarting and unplugging and this, that, and the other thing. And you know, good Lord, now I'm down to using the phone as a hotspot, and so far so good. So we'll see how far we can go with this one. If at a certain point you realize that one of us can't hear the other, that probably means we're having problems again. Then again, at that point, I'll probably have deleted the podcast, so you'll never hear it. So anyway. Anyhow, we are actually here tonight to unwrap number 11 on the greatest TV drama episodes of all time countdown. And that episode is the sixth episode of the, I would say, universally acclaimed Watchmen series that was titled This Extraordinary Being. Now, before we turn back the clock, and yes, there'll be plenty of clock and time and watch puns in this podcast, I'm sure. Before we turn back the clock to delve into the history of the series, and most importantly, that episode, here's my hopefully ever-increasingly brief version of my countdown disclaimer. As I've said many times before, despite Dan trying to poke the bear in the last episode, this countdown is not really representative of my own personal choices or biases. It's stat-driven, because I culled together a number of articles and ranking website databases that focus on the best or greatest TV episodes of all time. I pulled that information together, weeded out the candidates that had already been extensively covered on our podcast, and made sure to limit this to just one episode per series so we'd end up with 20 entirely different and therefore unique TV series. Yes, there may have been a couple instances where you could say that my bias might have come in if there was a quote-unquote tiebreaker, but those literally couple times were really splitting hairs between two episodes. And let's be honest, I don't want to have ties in the countdown. And yeah, that's pretty much it. That may or may not even apply to tonight's episode, but we can talk about that later in the podcast. Because I would say, bias-wise, I'm on the fence if this is my favorite episode of the series or not. On some levels it is, and on some levels it isn't. But we'll get into that. First, even though I know most folks out there know probably have extensive knowledge about Watchmen, I'm still going to give you a little history lesson because that's what I know. As most of you should know at this point, Watchmen started out as a 12-part comic book series way back in 1986. It was written by Alan Moore, man I've mentioned briefly in other comic book-related podcasts, you know, spewing info here and there. It's pretty much renowned for its quite subversive and game-changing storytelling that made it one of the truly historic landmarks of in comic book history, I should say. And that was a decade that saw a few events like that, such as Crisis on Infinite Earths and The Dark Knight Returns. Oh, and please note, all of these earth-shifting comic books were put out by DC Comics, not Marvel. Take that, true believers. Anyway. Well, we could spend not just one, but probably several podcasts just going over the life and times of Alan Moore. But contrary to the thoughts of a few of our listeners, we actually don't have time for that. I'll just say that his massive contributions to the comic book medium include everything from his virtual reinvention of Swamp Thing, obviously Watchmen, the still controversial Killing Joke, V for Vendetta, and the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. We're not even going to get into his later, probably equally landmark work they did for Image Comics and so many other titles over the last couple decades. He's also known for being a bit of an oddly eccentric curmudgeon. Yeah, and it takes one to know one. Yeah, I know. with a, let's just say, a rather unconventional married life. If you want to know, just look him up online. You'll find it. Trust me. And finally, it should be noted, he's pretty much disavowed any adaptations of his work. By and large, if you've read his stories and then you've seen the subsequent adaptations, more often than not, you can kind of understand why. Speaking of which, back to Watchmen, which is what we're supposed to be talking about. I'm pretty sure everybody knows it was adapted into a film by Zack Snyder back in 2009. I'm going to say that's a guy in my mind. That's the epitome of why Alan Moore would want nothing to do with adaptations. Not going to get into my opinions on that movie. There are things I like about it. There are things I don't like about it. It looks damn good. But that's the one thing about Zack Snyder's work. If nothing else, it always looks good. Other issues, well, you know. But we can just move the clock roughly 10 years up to Damon Lindelof. And we all know who Damon Lindelof is. You all know he's probably best known and beloved by too many of our listeners for being one of the main minds behind TV series like Lost and The Leftovers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Two shows that may or may not end up showing somewhere in the countdown. We shall see. Duh. His decision, which was and still is considered pretty much as bold as it gets, was not to do yet another version of the original 86 comic book series, but rather to use that story as the background and foundation for an entirely different tale that takes place decades later. If the original comic books were really about deconstructing the myth of the superhero while making, I would say, significant commentaries about society, our moral values, and the corruption of the body politic, well, Lindelof, he does not shy away from some of those issues as well, but he also decided to open up the story to digging deeper and really ripping off the scabs of society in terms of racial relations, subjugation, and violence. And it's also, you can't help but notice, especially over this past year, when everything from the prevalence of people wearing masks to the racial inequality issues and tensions that are explored, this series was eerily prescient. Because it finished its turn right around the end of 2019, and we all know what happened in this country, and really specifically in this, did I say country? Yeah, I said country. In this country in 2020. So, Court, I know that you have quite the geeky tendencies like me. So I was wondering about before you came to the series, and when you heard about it, what was your experience with had you read the comics initially? Had you not read them? Had you just seen the movie? What was the fertile Courtney mind before this series started?
I had not read the series. My introduction to it was, oh, Jeffrey Dean Morgan is going to be who? The comedian in this 2009 Zack Snyder film? Yeah, I want to see that. What? I got a babysit? No, I already bought my tickets. Oh, okay, they'll come with me. So, yeah. Midnight showing. Children. Me. Oof. Blue dick. but we all fell asleep, so it was fine. Yeah, I remember not enjoying that movie at all. And then, like, right before the show was supposed to come out, I said, let me try this movie again. Like, 10 years later, maybe I have a different mindset. Let me see. And there are no children here. So I did watch it again, and I enjoyed it way better than I did during that first showing. But it still wasn't the best thing I'd ever seen.
Right. Yeah. For me, back in 1986, I wasn't working as of yet, so I'm not even sure how I ever had any spending money. So I was still, I think, buying comic books from time to time, but I didn't buy the comics in 86 when they were released on a monthly basis. I think I got my first job in 87, so shortly thereafter that, once they had been put in a collection, it was one of the early trade paperback kind of things. I got it that way. So in a way, I got to binge it, so to speak, in comic book terms, as opposed to the monthly issues. I really like the comic book series. I don't hold it in quite as high a level of esteem as some of my fellow comic book fans do. I think it's very good, and I understand its importance just for comic books in general. There are just stories I would pick that I think are more important or really just better. But it's still very, very good, and I get why it was such a big deal. I swear I just heard my exhaust fan. It's been silent for a week and a half. Anyway, so when we got to the movie, I was intrigued by the movie, and I hadn't built up any Zack Snyder animosity at that point. That movie might have started, quite frankly. I like the look of it. There are certain the visuals. Zack Snyder, there it is. You can't knock him on his visuals. You can just knock him on pretty much everything else. I mean, I was getting annoyed with, like, this is the most obvious soundtrack ever put together for a movie.
Very much so.
did they just, like, get the Forrest Gump soundtrack? And it's like, oh, we'll just use that. You know, it's just like, oh, pick every obvious song possible for every scene. And then the changes that were made, which were fairly substantial, especially when you get to the third act. I didn't love the movie. I didn't hate it. I was just like, eh, it wasn't, I didn't think it was a great adaptation, but at that point, you know, quality comic book movies are few and far between. You know, mm-hmm. The MCU was just getting started around that time. You know, we did have, you know, we it was around the time of The Dark Knight, so we did have that at least, but you know.
Yeah.
So, but when I heard about the series, I was like, huh, that's interesting. Especially when I heard that it wasn't going to be covering the same ground again. They were going to do something different. But maybe go, so is it a continuation? And that was what I initially thought. And then I heard a little bit more about it. I was like, huh, that's very curious. Okay, all right. I'm intrigued. And then, you know, first night it's on, you're watching it, and that opening, you know, those first several minutes of the first episode were just like knocked my socks off.
Absolutely.
Yeah, to me, that's like the TV version of, you know, the first 20 something minutes of Saving Private Ryan or something like that, where you're just like, wow. And the fact that just that scene alone, that alone started a conversation in this country. Because, you know, and myself being included among those people, we're not aware that this had happened, that this event had happened. And then, you know, so I'm thinking, did they make this? This is just, you know, a fictional thing they made up for the series. And as I'm watching it, and then I'm realizing, wait, there's something that sounds vaguely familiar about this. And then you realize, you go online, you know, after the show is over, realize, oh, Jesus Christ, this actually happened. Holy crap. And, you know, it's interesting that it got covered again, you know, in another series in 2020. It was just like, well, that's kind of a weird coincidence. But that's a different series for a different conversation. So, we're going to be focusing on what would be the sixth episode of the season. I'll see if I can kind of nutshell what's going on with the season leading up to this episode. You know, as we've been talking about, you know, this actually takes place 34 years after the events of the comic book series. And that is what they're using, thankfully, as the foundation here. They're not paying any attention to that movie. So yes, there is a giant squid that was dropped on New York City, which they did not do in the movie. Anyway, as readers of that comic and viewers of this series will know, you know, former vigilante superhero and billionaire genius Adrian Veidt, you know, Ozymandias, you know, he had perpetuated that whole semi-hoax on the world when the U.S. and the Soviet Union were on the brink of nuclear war. And like I said, he dropped that gigantic squid-like thing on New York City, because of course it has to be New York, killing millions. And the event was thought of as some sort of interdimensional alien attack that united the world and tamped down the threat of mutual nuclear annihilation. At the time, the vigilante Rorschach, he was considered kind of an outlaw by the authorities, actually, like all vigilantes, because they had been exposed and banned at the time. He was primed to expose you know, Adrian's crimes when, I guess, presumably for the betterment of mankind, he ends up being vaporized by the omniscient Dr. Manhattan, who then departs Earth to, well, hang out on Mars. Then we can fast forward to this series, 2019, and you have a white supremacist group known as the 7th Cavalry. Apparently, they've taken Rorschach's diaries and journals and pretty much twisted what their original meaning and intention was. They kind of turned it into like a Travis Bickle meets Mein Kampf kind of level kind of thing. They've been waging war on minorities, the authorities, pretty much anyone connected to the reparations that President Robert Redford, yep, he's not Sundance anymore, had instituted years earlier. With police having so often being in the crosshairs, especially after this major violent event that's referred to as the White Night, where at least 40 police officers and their families were murdered, police are now wearing masks themselves, keeping their identities secret, kind of like superheroes. In fact, there's actually a couple costume vigilantes who work for the police, such as Sister Night, Looking Glass, the Red Menace, and Pirate Jenny. Over the course of these first five episodes of the season, the police chief, who's played really nicely by Don Johnson, it's one of those things that you realize, oh, Don Johnson's a much better actor than I would have given credit for back in the Miami Vice days.
Hey.
I actually do like Don Johnson, as long as he's not singing, although he does sing in that episode. So there is that.
He did it well.
He did it well. Not like that album he released back in the 80s. I mean, Bruce Willis' album was much better. Anyway, that police chief is murdered in a lynching-style hanging, whereas Angela Abar, a.k.a. Sister Night, finds a 100-year-old man in a wheelchair seated beneath his hanging body, claiming that he is the murderer, and also that he's Angela's grandfather. That puts Angela on the trail of the truth behind her grandfather, the death and life of her police chief, and his connections to the 7th Cavalry, and there's this huge overarching plot where there's essentially two separate entities. You got the 7th Cavalry, and then you have this organization, True, or I think that's how you pronounce it, Industries, that are both trying to bring back Dr. Manhattan and use him for, let's just say, for nefarious purposes, even if maybe they don't actually see it that way. There is a whole lot more going on in those five episodes. I mean, I'm not even going to get into whatever the heck you think was going on with Adrian Veidt, who is still alive and turned out to be on a, you know, another planet or a moon of another planet, I should say. And it seems like he's kind of gone insane. But also, if I'm going to mention him, I got to say, bravo. The casting of Jeremy Irons as an older Adrian Veidt is really spot on casting. I mean, really excellent. So let's get to the episode. Let's also get to so we can actually hear Court instead of me for a bit. This episode, This Extraordinary Being, it was directed by Stephen Williams. This man, he's second only to Jack Bender in terms of how many Lost episodes this dude has directed. 26 episodes. Bender directed 38. For fellow great TV fans, he's also the guy who directed the better than excellent Do Male Robots Dream of Electric Sheep episode of The Americans, which is probably one of their three or four best episodes. And he's also directed a handful of myriad of other worthwhile series. You know, look him up on IMDb, take my word for it. Westworld, Person of Interest, Counterpart. Ooh, Counterpart. Such a good show. And it was written by Damon Lindelof and Cord Jefferson. Cord Jefferson, who beyond his writing chores in Watchmen, he's also written for TV series like The Good Place and Master of None. So interesting writing resume for Mr. Jefferson there. So, let's get to the breakdown of the episode. Now, I was talking to Court a little bit about before the podcast, before all the system malfunctions were happening on my end. And I've listened to the previous 9 installments of our countdown, and I noticed they tend to go a little bit better when I give them more of a full tilt breakdown and recap, because it just gives us a little more structure to our conversation. You know, when I decide to wing it, maybe not so good. So I am going to go full tilt recap here, and then we will converse as we and chatty chat all about the episode as I go through it. So, you know, hashtag it's all about me, hashtag podcast poison, you know. Hashtag how much you paying for this? So, Court, right off the bat, and again, I haven't watched the episode since it aired last year, and And as you were saying, you know, this isn't even like a regular, it was just a year ago. You know, 2020 makes everything seem at least 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, 2020, everything's a multiple of like 5 or 10. You know, I noticed that, you know, although every episode does something kind of fun and special with the opening title credit, I had kind of forgotten that at the very start of this episode, you see the title Watchmen just disappear in a puff of smoke and become Minutemen. So right before, I was like, oh, I kind of forgot about that. Which actually, I guess, is their segue to get into the scene from the TV series that we've seen on TVs occasionally throughout the show called American Hero Story. And in this scene, great scene, Hooded Justice is being rather crudely questioned by two FBI agents about sex stuff. And a roll of film.
And Hoover.
a roll of film that Captain Metropolis has that he supposedly, I guess he's holding over J. Edgar Hoover's head, is either blackmail or leverage. I mean, Watchmen is already known for, whether you go to the comics or any of these versions, because it's an alternate reality, but you are working in, you know, actual historical figures. You know, the comic infamously was Nixon, because Nixon was still president and stuff. And this one now, even though they never choose to depict him on screen, which would have been interesting, but, you know, Robert Redford. So here, of course, you know, referencing J. Edgar Hoover. And yes, people have come over the years to know about J. Edgar Hoover had certain proclivities himself, supposedly. So they're trying to force Hooded Justice, who they know has been just one of those other folks that Captain Metropolis has been, shall we say, intimate with, to take off his mask so they can photograph him and thus be able to hold that over him in order to get him to obtain that roll of film for them. But maybe they make a little mistake when they say that no one knows that he's there with them at that moment. So, yeah, he takes off his cowl, and just as the less talkative agent Jerry is about to snap his picture, Hooded Justice proceeds to beat the living crap out of them, which culminates in this murderous smashing together of their heads. So I kind of thought that was like a nice little start to the episode. And I also like it once you've watched the entire thing and you realize there's a certain thematic reason for having that scene there. That's the way I looked at it in my rewatch, at least.
Exactly. Like when I first watched it the first time around, like, yes, I always enjoy it when they have like different kind of a, not metaphysical. My brain is not working right now because it's late.
I'm sorry.
Metafiction. Like when they have that additional elements, like different TV shows where there's another interior life happening within that one. So I completely missed it the first time around. Like, I cannot believe how much of this episode that I did not remember. But like there, the levels in this, like the layers that they play into this, and like just the facts of who is the hero and like what was it, Mr. Metropolis, Captain Metropolis?
Captain Metropolis.
Oh my God. Geez. And I wanted to ask you, because I didn't read the comics. We talked about that. Like how much of the actual like the metafiction part of that is based in the comics? Like, did they pull any of that from the comics? I know you said Nixon.
Well, there is a certain level of that in the comics. Absolutely. I mean, it's a very self-aware thing. It's not anything that we're seeing in this series, because this is, you know, 2019, and that comic was, you know, 1985 or 6 or whatever, 85, I think. So it wasn't anything like that. But there are a lot of. And that, and again, that had not, and what they do in that comic had not really been done in comics before. I mean, occasionally there might be kind of cute little weird little in jokes in comic books, or you might have the weird one where, hey, Spider-Man teams up with the Not Ready for Primetime Players of Saturday Night Live in one comic or something. But by and large, you really didn't do that. But that series kind of really was one of the ones known for really twisting things. You know, it's much like The Dark Knight Returns does to a certain extent also with, you know, with Ronald Reagan and a takeoff on like David Letterman and Paul Schaefer, who are among those who get murdered by the Joker in one scene and stuff. But yeah, the comic does do stuff like that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed that. And the fact that they made like the TV hero, like a white guy, which is who they thought that Hood of Justice was from what we saw in this episode. It reminded me of the whole thing with Bass Reeves and like the Lone Ranger.
Right, right. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
I never thought of that. That's good. Okay.
Yeah. So like just pulling connections and different things like that.
Oh, absolutely. What's interesting, it's kind of just holding a mirror up, like, this is what we perceive has been the truth, but it's not the actual truth.
Yeah. Which, and that's funny, because that goes back to the first episode where we had that history lesson. A lot of people didn't know about it. I think I had heard about it before, like the Tulsa Massacre, but, like, there are so many elements of our history in this country that we have no idea about. I really hope that we get more of that, like mainstream, like lessons about like the truth in the past.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, good Lord, we've had enough whitewashing over the years.
Ooh. Yeah.
Emphasis on the word white. That's right. Anyway, so then we switch from there. We have Sister Night or Angela. She's in a cell. She's presumably not, this is presumably not long after she just swallowed her grandfather's nostalgia pills. Mm-hmm. Agent Blake, who, for those keeping score at home and are remembering the original Watchmen comics or even that movie, she's actually was the one who once was Silk Spectre. She's a former costume vigilante herself, although she certainly doesn't talk that way anymore. She wants Angela to reveal where her grandfather is hiding, as well as trying to convince her to sign a release so they can pump her stomach free of the nostalgia. She gives Angela, and really it's giving the audience, kind of the 411 about what nostalgia pills are, how they were originally conceived as a medication for older dementia patients, but also the use just spread to others, and it led to addiction and overdosing and such until President Redford and the FDA pretty much outlawed it. But while Blake is talking to her, things start getting kind of weird and distorted, and all of a sudden you see, I would say, pieces of her grandfather's memories start to seep into the frame, like his mother playing piano at the old movie house, you know, that we saw in that opening scene once again before the Tulsa riots, or a drummer at what turns out to be a New York police cadet graduation, and all of a sudden, boom, she's there.
And she's not just there, she's him.
Oh, yeah.
That was fantastic.
And apparently her grandfather's memories were filmed in black and white. So
of course.
I'm not sure if that's also a subliminal racial commentary as well. That just popped into my head. But I love that with one simple camera movement, we shift from it being Regina King, you know, Angela, in place of her grandfather, to the actor, I think his name is Hovan Adepo, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I apologize to the actor. It's the only time I'm going to say his name in the whole podcast, trust me. He's the young Will Reeves getting his badge pinned on him by a fellow black officer, Lieutenant Battle, who also discreetly warns him to beware of the Cyclops. Shortly thereafter, we see Will meeting up with June, who is a reporter for the Amsterdam News, for drinks. For folks who aren't from New York or don't know things about New York from years ago, there has been, I don't know if it's still in publication or not, but I know when I was growing up, there was a publication, the Amsterdam News, which was a newspaper which, shall we say, did tailor to minorities. So that would make sense that June would work for that paper at that time. He brings up to her what he thinks her concerns are about, you know, as he says, a Negro cadet joining the police force, how the police have always treated or rather mistreated their people, and how he's just going to be another Tom. But her chief concern is that he's someone who's been handed a gun and a stick, and what he may end up doing, mm-hmm. not just because of based on what we've already talked about, but the horrors he saw and experienced going back to the Tulsa riots, you know. To quote her, you are an angry, angry man, William Reeves. I like the fact that, you know, I always can appreciate writing where you just gave me a whole lot of information in only a few lines. And I thought this is just one of the many scenes throughout this episode where they do a nice job of hiding exposition, and they tell me a lot, and they tell me both story, history, and character all at the same time. And that, to me, is the mark of, like, really upper echelon writing. And I thought they did a really nice job with it here.
Absolutely.
And just to echo something you had mentioned moments ago, and because I don't want to keep saying it throughout the podcast, I might say it once or twice more, but I want to say it every time. As we run through the events of this episode, it should really be noted that we sometimes briefly shift back and forth between seeing Angela literally following in her grandfather's footsteps, as if inhabiting his body and soul in the past, as well as seeing things like his mother randomly showing up on a street corner playing the piano or other unexpected spots, you know, and usually she's in color while everything else is in black and white. And then you get other rather surreal scene changes, like walking through a doorway that magically acts like a portal to a totally different location. It's very much like you're just continuing the stream of a memory in a dreamlike form. And that's kind of how I took it whenever they would do things like that. So we're with Officer Reeves, and then he's on, you know, I think he's pretty much walking his beat, I guess. And he spots a man lighting and subsequently tossing a Molotov cocktail through the window of a Jewish delicatessen. This man, who we shortly come to only know as Fred, they decide not to give him a last name, nonchalantly strolls down the alley as Officer Reeves shouts for him to stop in the name of the law, much like the character you mentioned, Bart Reeves, actually. So Will arrests him, and at first it seems like despite Fred casually denying the charge, another officer coldly scolds the way too cocky son of a bitch to apologize for calling Reeves a spook. But as the other officer is leading Fred away to be booked, we see that cop make a signal on his forehead with his hand. A signal we might suspect at that moment, and later learn for sure, is a code for that so-called Cyclops Reeves was warned about at graduation. So at this point in the episode, I was enjoying the fact that we're getting history on, you know, her grandfather, whatever, but I like a mystery. And so we got ourselves a little bit of a mystery to figure out as well. And Lindelof is behind this. Of course, it's got to be a mystery somewhere, right?
Of course.
So I'm also enjoying like recognizing actors from different things. Like the guy who plays Fred, you know, he's been on like every other HBO series. If you've been paying attention, it's like, oh, he's in the first season of True Detective. Oh, he's in, you know, multiple seasons of Boardwalk Empire. Like he's always that guy. But I was like, at this point, it's drawing me in more because it's like, okay, I'm wondering what that's about. And of course, if they want to draw me in anymore, the very next scene, you have this brief moment with the newsstand dealer who's reading and describing Action Comics number one, which is only the most famous comic book in the history of the world. And that's where Will learns that Fred was released, and this desk sergeant advises him to let it go. He asks about it, you know, he asks about that hand to head gesture, and then he's told, just go home, let it be. And that's the point where I start worrying. I start worrying about Will. I was like, he's making noise here. I kind of had a bad feeling. I think I know what's going to happen fairly soon. And I was pretty much right because it happened pretty soon after that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, while he's walking home in civvies later, that cop car pulls up beside him, insisting on driving him home or going out for a beer. And he declines. And there's that really haunting shot when the police car pulls away. But we see that it's dragging. It's like two of the victims from the Tulsa riots are tied to its bumper. And that's one of those images that kind of stayed with me.
Oh yeah, and like the scene is in black and white, but you get that splash of red, and I'm like, oh my god.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting because with just that one quick moment, it says so much, and it's making the commentary. It's making it to me. And probably to most viewers, or many viewers, I should say, it's maybe a commentary beyond the series. Mm-hmm. It's going to be that kind of a podcast. Come on, Corey.
No, and like it's shocking because I feel like I'm going back to the first episode. Like before we got that first episode with the Tulsa massacre, this is not something that's usually talked about. it's not shown like for a mainstream audience,
right?
I'll say, like, if you want this kind of content about like actual Black history and what actually went on, like, you'd have to look hard for it. Right. So the fact that we're getting something like this really super popular series, and they're actually going to tell this story, and like, they're going to be brutal about it and as honest about it as they were, like, it's shocking. It hurts, but it's good to see. Because, like you said, people started asking questions, and it's wild that we got this before the year that is 2020, because we know all the stuff that had happened in 2020, and like all the other things that it had, all the people who died beforehand, all right. names.
Right.
So.
Right. It's also interesting because then you had at least a handful of other TV series that start to like dip their toe or out and out dive into these things as well.
Yeah.
And I'm not, and there, and the couple that come to mind, they're fine series. Don't get me wrong. But the only weird thing that would happen as a result was you couldn't help but compare them to Watchmen. And,
oh, absolutely.
And you couldn't help, you know, we'll just step outside the conversation, go on a little tangent just for a moment. What the hell? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe there's a big major scene, moment, whatever you want to call it, in Lovecraft Country.
Yes, where they the whole go, episode.
Where they go back to the Tulsa riots.
Yes, they
which
do.
Made me go, wow, HBO is really going all in on the Tulsa riots. Whatever. And not to knock Lovecraft Country, actually, they do a different but very good job dealing with that issue, and really how it has a very strong connection to specific characters and what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think that's how I think it works. It works because of what happens with those specific characters. But as far as giving me an overall view of the event and the horrors of it,
mm-hmm.
I went back to Watchmen. Like, no, I think Watchmen kind of just shocked me more. It's like, oh my god, the scope of it. You know, where it didn't, the Lovecraft didn't quite have that for me. It worked on just on a different level, like almost on a more personal level. As opposed to what they do in the opening with Watchmen, which is like, it's likened to war. If Lovecraft Country, is focusing on what's happening to one soldier, and you know, Watchmen is like, this is the entire battle.
Yeah, because it's like, you don't know these people yet, but this is what happened to them.
Exactly.
Whereas with Lovecraft, we were well into the series, and like you said, it had the connections that I won't spoil.
Right. But it's interesting, whether they intended it or not, as a result of Watchmen having aired, you know, almost a year earlier, though, now you have an audience that knows about the Tulsa riots, many of whom might not have beforehand. So it actually ended up helping in a way, because we were like, oh, I know what that's about.
Right.
You know, wow. But it also, for folks like me, I was like, oh, I wonder how they're going to depict it. Interesting. You know, will they have an airplane? You know, that kind of stuff. Anyway, I shouldn't make light, but I am. It's TV. So where are we? Oh, so after that, we see Reeves. He turns down an alley, and then the police car cuts him off. By the way, does anything good ever happen to anybody when they walk down an alley, especially at night?
Not ever.
When I was a kid, on the next block from where I lived, and I grew up in Brooklyn, of course, there was this place that we called Dead Man's Alley. It wasn't really an alley, by the way. Not really. I mean, it starts out a little bit. It was more like you walk behind an apartment building, and then all of a sudden there's a weird staircase which led to this corridor, and it came out through a courtyard, then snaked around to the other side of the block. If you went into the corridor at night, it was for about 15, 20 seconds, you're like in pitch blackness.
Yeah.
Before all of a sudden, I'll say, oh, now I see light again. So it was kind of like the thing kids would do to scare themselves. And then when we come up in the courtyard, there was like this thing that just looked like a big dirt patch, which we all said was like a graveyard. This stuff that kids do. Anyway.
Well, but let me interrupt you real quick.
Go ahead.
I can kind of see where Will's head was and trying to think, oh, let me duck into this alley and get out of sight. Because what they did to him, they could have just as easily have done that in the middle of the street and not expected to get any kind of reprimand on it. Like, oh, we know that. He knows that. And so for him, he was taking himself as a target away from them. I want to know how they found him so quickly. Had they already been following him and knew his pattern?
I'm assuming they know where he lives.
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
So they kind of probably anticipated. They probably as the car goes by, they could be seeing him in their rearview mirror, so they might have known that he was going to turn down that alley, maybe that's the traditional route he takes for all we know. Because normally, maybe no one screws with him because he's a big strapping dude. But unfortunately, that's what happens here, and they proceed to beat him with their nightsticks, and it leads to what appears to be a full-scale lynching when they're hanging him from a tree. We see from his point of view that they've also apparently put a hood over his head. And it's just at the moment where the car's headlights are dimming through the material and you realize he's about to lose consciousness and perhaps even die. That's when they cut him down. It's with essentially a warning that if he sticks his nose where it doesn't belong again, they're going to hang him for real. Those are not the words they use. There are certain words I'm probably not going to use on the podcast. There's a few I will. There's one I'm not going to. So... because, Court will beat the shit out of me. So
boundaries are great. I'm glad when people know that line.
Yeah, that's
you line. Can talk about it without nobody has to say it.
I know how to refer to
it. I know, yeah.
She's still a good friend of mine for many years now. Even had a dalliance way back in the day. Friend of mine who talked to her when Survivor's on. We talk every week about Survivor, so we've maintained a connection even though she's living off in Chicago. And I don't remember the circumstances or the context way back when, but I remember coming up with a way to say that word without saying that word, where it was kind of riffing on Blazing Saddles, where they say the sheriff is near. Whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, hey, if you take that word and then you take out a bunch of letters and you stick an apostrophe there, then it's near. So I would say that deliberately, and she would just get pissed off at me and slap me somewhere.
Yeah, don't do that.
I know 2020, woke, I know, whatever.
No, not woke. No, don't.
I know. So... Well, it was 1998. Anyway, so it is worth saying that in this instance, the shift also once again goes to it being Angel, being bloodied and gasping for air, which probably makes it almost more powerful, because Angel's kind of experiencing things kind of the way we're experiencing things to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's also as shocking it is to see anyone beaten and that happen to them. You start going up the levels when you see, it being a woman just makes it just that much more, I think. Just like, oh, Jesus. Plus, we all love Regina King, so there's that too,
Yeah.
So at that point, he's wandering home. He still has the noose around his neck. And that hood is still clutched in his hands. And he happens upon a couple that's being menaced by several thugs. So that's when he puts on the hood and he leaps into action, wailing on the crooks and saving the couple. And when he arrives home to June, he admits, he's angry.
You saw that anger just be loosed upon the criminal. So yay, vigilante.
Yeah, and that's when we know that, and that's the point where even though we probably should have anticipated that, you realize, we're getting a full blown superhero origin story. And if you're a comic book geek of any years, you always look forward to how you pull off an origin and whether you do it well or not.
Yeah, and I was going to say, but yay, nobody's parent dies, but his did, but not recently.
But, yeah, okay, right. No, you're right. That's true. There you go. Just like Superman. Anyway. So the next afternoon, June shows him that his hooded exploits made the papers. And she asked, why did he put on the hood? And his response is he doesn't know why. But then June recalls the movie, that movie that we've talked about here, that he watched numerous times as a child, the one that kicked off the season, Trust in the Law, the one about, Bass Reeves, the black crime fighter who defeats a corrupt white sheriff. Interesting. Wait, are they doing another parallel? And we later see June applying makeup around his eyes so no one will know that it's a black man under the hood. If he's deciding to become a vigilante crime fighter, hooded justice. While obviously that wasn't their point of doing that in the series or in this episode, I should say, putting aside all the major issues of race, whatever, I also think it's kind of funny because, you know, that's something that in live action versions of Batman for the last 40 years, there's been this tendency like, okay, we have to do black makeup around the eyes because it looks weird to have flesh, you know, have flesh color showing through the eye holes. So it's kind of, it was almost like the reversal image of that. So I thought that was kind of interesting too.
Yeah. Like you got to make it blend.
Yeah.
Make it look more like a bat.
There you go. And that's why in the upcoming Robert Pattinson one, they're actually showing him putting on that makeup. It's like, well, finally someone's showing them do it because Michael Keaton clearly is doing it. Because if you watch Batman or Batman Returns, he clearly has black makeup on. Anyway.
Yeah. It would look weird the other way.
Yeah. Although Adam West is like, it didn't look weird for me. Shut up. Anyway, so
Adam West is a little different. And it worked.
A little bit. One thing I need to say, the soundtrack for this show, and for this episode specifically, but just for the series in general, it's dynamite. But right at this point in the episode, they cue up I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, one of those songs by the Ink Spots. You know, pretty famous song, but at the time, and I'm saying it again, some TV viewers might have also recognized it as it was as we had seen it being used with black and white cinematography before, because it was used in the fourth season opener of Better Call Saul. So I tie that together. So I remember I was watching, like, huh, that's interesting. And oh, by the way, and I'll get to it, but I'm going to skip ahead just because, you know, I'm breaking my own chronology here. They use another Ink Spot song later on in the episode. I think it's My Echo, My Shadow, and Me, if I'm not mistaken. Which was also used on Better Call Saul in a different season opener in black and white. So, coincidence? No. All right. So, anyway, back to Will Reese. His first plan is to hunt down that guy named Fred. Wouldn't it have been easier if he actually had a last name for Fred? I'm just wondering. If he never got a last name, how was he able to hunt them down?
Well, he didn't actually book him.
But he should have said with your whole name. Anyway, so he figures by hunting down Fred and by doing that, maybe he'll be able to uncover the entire secret behind the whole beware of the Cyclops thing. And he finds their hideout is behind this market that Fred owns in Queens. So when he busts in, turns out, hey, they're all wearing clown robes. So you get this big fight scene. And you know what? Just like punching Nazis, or actually pretty much kind of is like punching Nazis, there's something really satisfying about watching Klansmen getting their asses kicked. So, of course, and, you know, it's not a coincidence that he's all dressed all in black, being held out of these evil people that are dressed all in white, which also parallels that film that opened up the season because, you know, the sheriff's dressed all in white, but, you know, Bass Reeves is wearing all black. So you got this repeating themes that they're, you know, really hitting you with the colors there, I think, which obviously are reflective of the colors of their skin as well. So while he's there, you know, there's a brief respite in the fight, and he finds a map, a list of cities, and a book on mesmerism. Mm. And when the fight moves to the front of the store, Fred is, well, a few customers are there, and all of a sudden Fred opens fire with a shotgun, and Will escapes by jumping through the storefront window. And I got to say, this is a shot that's caught and freeze-framed in an exquisitely gorgeous manner. It's one of the visual high points of the entire episode. And this episode is like visual high point, you know, studded, I would say. And it's at that moment that Agent Blake walks over to Hooded Justice, who's literally frozen in time. The shards of glass are speckling all around. Well, I'm going to say him but as Agent Blake is speaking to Hooded Justice, we realize it's Angela's under the hood again. We see her eyes. And Blake tells the frozen Angela that she swallowed a lethal dose of nostalgia. And what might be causing this freeze in the memory is a shot of adrenaline they just gave Angela, apparently, in the real world. So Cal, Angela's husband, who we haven't mentioned as of yet, is apparently with Blake, and He comes over and he tries to read to Angela in hopes of waking her up, freeing her from the dangerous clutches of being in her grandfather's memories here. And he starts listing her different biographical details, that she's Angela Abar, she was born in Saigon in 1976, and so on. But unfortunately for them, we actually end up shifting ahead in the memoryscape, and we're back to June, and she's talking to Will about FDR, and that's when a man named Nelson Gardner knocks at the door. Mm. It's funny, the actor who plays Nelson Gardner, I had seen probably that same year, maybe for the first time. No, second time, because I'd seen him on two other things. And he was in a TV version, I think they did, of the movie Limitless.
Yes, they did.
I think that's him. And the other thing I remember from when they brought back Murphy Brown.
Is that who that was?
That's his son. Yeah, that's the actor playing her son.
Right.
So I had been more used to seeing him playing these, kind of comedy. And Limitless wasn't obviously it was a drama, but it was kind of light and fun. Actually, I think it deserved to last a little bit longer than it did. Which I don't know if it made it beyond. I don't think it made it beyond one season. I don't even know if it got a full season. But I kind of liked it. It was kind of like Chuck, whatever. Not as good as Chuck, but it was just interesting because I see the character walk in and you kind of know where they're going to be going with this. So I was just very interesting. And being in black and white with that blonde hair, he's oh so pretty. he's like an effeminate Steve Rogers, quite frankly. I probably shouldn't have said effeminate, but who cares? So he's there on behalf of Captain Metropolis, who's a famous costumed vigilante who's forming a team of like-minded patriots called the New Minutemen. But he's not there thinking that Will is Hooded Justice. No, no, no. He thinks he's a cop that's feeding Hooded Justice information, which cracks June up, especially when she refers to Captain Metropolis as mocking the whole thing, the whole idea of him being a strategic mastermind. Because he's clearly not perceptive enough to realize Will is the hero that inspired him. Not to mention that it's fairly obvious to June and probably anyone with half a brain that this guy is, in fact, Captain Metropolis himself. I thought that I actually think that's, speaking of meta, I think that that was kind of one of the, in an episode that you wouldn't feel they were going to get very meta because of what the issues are dealing with, that still felt like a little bit of a meta wink to me.
For sure.
Anyone out there, I thought it like a wink of, it's usually inconceivable how no one ever recognizes heroes doing a little more than like a little Harlequin mask covering their eyes. Come on. Like if your friend showed up in a little mask, oh, who are you? Where'd my friend go? That doesn't make any sense. There is a question like, why should he join the team? And June pretty much is just almost ignored in the scene where she's like, he shouldn't. And then Gardner's line, which is just so, because brave men like him are rare specimens, and why fight alone when you can have true companionship? Wow.
Yeah. like literally flirting with your husband right in front of you.
it was beautifully beautifully and deliberately cringe inducing. It was just,
yeah.
It kind of reminds me of the Boy Scouts a little bit. But, oh, no, one of our listeners is a Boy Scout. I'll hear about it from him now. Did you think that June noticed when Gardner passes Will his police his business card and their fingers kind of, so briefly touch?
I don't think she noticed it then.
Okay. Because I remember I was watching it, and then I actually rewound it. It's like, does she? I said, I don't think she does because I don't know if she makes a comment at any point later on about it. There are things that are about to happen, that we're about to talk about, that are code for other things, but I don't think June does that. So I'm going to say she probably didn't.
Yeah.
And if anyone, go on.
And I was going to say, and the only reason I think I was really sensitive, so their byplay, is because the episode of Hooded Justice that we got at the top of the episode. Oh, they were lovers? Okay.
It kind of prepared you.
Exactly.
I would, Also, if you're watching the previous episode, which is a really good episode, which focuses a lot on Looking Glass, there's at one point he's watching something at home, which pretty much looks like it's porn of Captain Metropolis and Hooded Justice having sex. So we already kind of had that thought placed in. So I remember thinking at the time, like, is he watching porn or is this an episode of that show, and then just really explicit, because it kind of feels porny to me. And if it's porn, what are you saying about Looking Glass? Wait, I'm very confused right now. It's okay, but we never get an okay. Anyway, so and of course, from this scene, we cut right to the two men having sex.
Of course,
no time wasted.
You've been prepared.
Yeah. And I love the conversation that they're having in bed, you know, the whole, like, when did you know? And I love it's kind of a subversive little gag here because, you know, you think when he first says it, they're talking about this, their sexual preference, as opposed to, you know, his identity of Hooded Justice, which is what they're supposed to be talking about. But come on, that's not what they're really talking about.
Right.
He does ask about the others on the team. Will they accept him? And again, if you can listen to that conversation, it seems now it's about race is on the surface, but it really feels like it's more about sexuality. It could be both.
I felt like it was a little bit of both.
I'm going to say it's both, but there's, I feel there's, I'll use a word a friend of mine uses way too much. You know, it's a subtext. But but also it's interesting using it as a subtext because the story at this point, we're in the 19, where are we, in the 30s now? Yes, yeah, I think it's it's the 30s, right? Yeah, there aren't Nazis yet, but I think it's the World War II is on the horizon, if I'm not mistaken. Whatever, you get the idea. The point I was about to make was if you watch movies from that time period, there's a lot of movies, especially in the 30s and 40s, you know, in particular, a little bit in the 50s too, actually, where they can't say certain things outright. So they get away with a lot of things when you realize, you know, like, you know what they're really trying to say here. I mean, you got to give these movies a lot more credit than maybe you had at first glance. Like, no, they're saying a lot more than you realize. You know, some are a little bit more obvious than others. You know, yeah, if you haven't figured out that Martin Landau is gay in North by Northwest, that's on you. But, so where were we? June is still against him joining, but they talk about a story that he's clearly told many times before. How after escaping the Tulsa riots and his parents were killed, you know, there's that baby he found wrapped in the flag when he was just a small boy himself. The reveal is that baby was June.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Now, I've heard of people, you know, falling for each other when they're like in high school or knowing each other growing up. But that's really taking it to an extreme.
I mean, like they were together. They bonded through this very traumatic thing that she barely remembered.
Right. It,
and like he's clearly always been there.
Yeah, clearly, absolutely. It's just one of those things. So I was trying at that moment. I put myself out of the story just for a second, trying to imagine like someone I was actually holding as a baby in my arms would be someone that I would eventually marry.
That's gross when you really think about it.
Yeah, exactly. I know he was a small child himself, so there's not that big a disparity in age. You know, he's probably like five there or something. I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
And so, you know, 5 years is nothing. I mean, take it somewhere, 25 years. But at that time, I was like, anyway. Oh, and it's at this point where they use, right after this is when they use that other Ink Spot song, the My Echo, My Shadow in Me. And one can make the analogies of what that song means as far as what's going on in the episode. It works there. I've already made analogies about that song and what it represents in Better Call Saul. I can't do it for another TV show. I'm just not going to do it. It worked better for Better Call Saul, just saying. But this is when we get a press conference for Hooded Justice joining the new Minutemen. And that's when it's made pretty clear that Captain Metropolis and the team are not really interested in pursuing Hood of Justice's mission against the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
And to make matters worse, it's not just that they've already gone commercial. You know, they've got this sponsorship at this bank or something. But then they reveal the publicity poster, which feels more than just a little racist. I was like, ooh.
No, straight up racist.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I'm trying to cushion things.
Yeah. Nope, we're not cushioning anything here.
Hashtag hard truth. So later, we see Officer Reeves show up at a movie theater where a violent riot has mysteriously broken out. The movie theater is in a Harlem neighborhood, and now the plot involving that book about mesmerism comes to light. That Cyclops is using mind control via these special strobing film projectors that they've devised to cause black people to turn on one another in the most extreme violent way possible. He tracks a truck outside the theater to a warehouse in the meatpacking district. And that's when he tries to call Captain Metropolis, who blows him off. Because, you know, conspiracies like this isn't the Minutemen's cup of tea. No, no. He'll have to solve black unrest on his own. Really, dude?
What are you here for?
I mean, Will totally goes like De Niro on the phone, and I was feeling it at that point. You know, it's like, oof. But again, it's just he turns and, you know, Fred No Name is there, and he laughingly offers Will, I guess, free steaks if he just wants to come along with him into the warehouse. But after he makes some increasingly racist comments himself, Will shoots him dead. And then he heads to the warehouse on his own, and he's putting the hood on, so you know shit's about to go down. When he goes into the warehouse, he's executing one after the other, who are all look like they're all packing special film projectors for their this insidious plot of theirs. He then enters another room and he finds a man. I wasn't clear at the first time I watched it if he was recording or transmitting the hypnotic commands.
I thought he was recording.
See, I assumed recording. That would make more sense. But the way the whole setup looked, it looked so elaborate, it made me think he was that it was being transmitted somewhere. But, you know, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter. I'm going to assume it makes more sense that he would be recording. But it was a very elaborate setup.
Yeah, no, because like you said, they were getting things ready to be shipped, like all the different equipment. So of course he's recording tapes that would go along with everything.
Right, that makes it totally makes more sense. I just was thinking about it in the moment, you know. Because sometimes I think so. Will's set to execute this dude as well, but his gun is empty, so he ends up strangling him with looks like it was the headphone wires. I think is what he strangles him with.
Yeah, because he ran out of bullets. Now, isn't this the same cop who, lynched him?
Yes.
Wasn't that? Okay.
Yeah, this was the cop who comes to his defense at the police station when Fred used that derogatory term. But then later we see him being part of the crew that beats him. And he's like, yeah, he's the one who threatened him. He's depicted as, like, the main cop.
Yeah.
Or the main bad cop, I should say. So basically, Will piles up the bodies and he sets it all ablaze. He takes one of the projectors with him and then he goes outside and he watches it all burn down. Very strong. Something about a fire in a black and white movie is always very kind of vividly striking, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's one arresting visual after the other. And there's just something about him being silhouetted against the flames, which is really kind of... It speaks to me. I don't know. But he comes home to find his son Marcus is putting on that eye makeup, dressing up as kind of a mini Hooded Justice. So he flips out a little bit, tries to wipe it off, and June pulls her son away, kind of pissed off at him, because right then and there she decides to leave him, you know, to take the boy back to Tulsa, because in her eyes, he's just never gotten rid of the anger. In fact, his activities as Hooded Justice have only fed it and made it worse, I guess.
And she totally knows about his relationship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was, when I saw that, I kept thinking, was she kind of letting it slide or not? I kept going.
I don't think she knew with the business card, but it's been years. Like, he has slipped up. She knows.
Well, you know, once a guy starts putting on eye makeup. Anyway, so just saying.
God.
I just watched 5 seasons of Schitt's Creek. Leave me alone. Anyway.
Excellent show.
It is. I'll be talking about that in a future podcast. So we leap forward in time, and now we're with the old Reeves, the Louis Gossett Jr. Reeves. He's, you know, in the wheelchair. And that's when we see he's got that flickering light from the old projector. Mm-hmm. And it all starts to come together now. And we see, mm-hmm. we see how a crippled 100-year-old man would be able to lynch Police Chief Judd Crawford all by himself. Well, he's not really crippled because when we see him not in a wheelchair. But anyway. And they had in this conversation, he actually brings up the Klan robe that was in Crawford's closet. You know, that was his grandfather's, his legacy. Why don't you hide it? And, you know, his only answer is, you don't know me, which is not a denial of his past right. or present or his involvement with the white supremacist or the sect known as Cyclops.
Why keep it? Like, why?
Yeah, it's... And I know it's interesting because the stuff with the chief, and obviously he's killed off in the very first episode, but there's something about him up until that point. He's damn likable, you know?
Oh, God, yeah.
And it's kind of one of the really fascinating things about the series because we keep finding out these things about him which kind of make our stomachs turn. I'm like, oof. But it's also, but I think, again, they're making a statement here, you know, that it's not always, not everyone wears it on their sleeve, so to speak.
Right.
So at that point, after elderly Will tells Judd to hang himself, we get that shift again, and it's Angela in the wheelchair holding the strobing light, watching as Judd is preparing to kill himself. And it's at this point all these other images start to bleed into the memory. You know, everything from Will's mother at the piano, the drummer from graduation day. All of a sudden, hey, there's the Minutemen. There's June, you know, telling him off. There's all these things. And then this considerably older woman appears. At this point, we don't know who she is, but for those of us who watch the next episode, we'll know that she's actually an older version of June, saying mm-hmm. she's ready to take her home. And at that point, Angela is becoming more and more frantic and disoriented in the wheelchair. And then she wakes up. She wakes up, and there is a rather almost disturbingly thick tube leading out of her arm.
Right?
And Lady True. Is it pronounced True? It's True, right? Or is it True?
I thought it was True. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's True. Who cares? I'm just, as you may or may not know, I'm notorious for mispronouncing things on this podcast, so I'm expecting to mispronounce things. That's why writers don't speak. And Lady True is there to welcome her back. If I'm not mistaken, isn't the next episode, isn't the tube leading to like an elephant or something?
Is it an elephant?
I think it's an elephant. Anyway, so... If you got that wrong, it's going to be really bad on the podcast. Don't know their facts about a show they just watched. Yeah. So, yeah, so that's basically the episode. So I probably should have given you more room to talk about. So talk now. What was your – I mean, there's so much going on in this. There's so much – it's so good. But it's interesting because – You're dealing with, until a miracle should happen, a limited series of 9 episodes. And which means you have a very limited time to tell a full story, you know, in miniseries parlance or maxi series, whatever the phrase is. And more so than any other episode of the series, and you don't really see this in limited series that often, this almost can function as a standalone episode. I mean, outside of a little bit at the beginning and end, what bookends it really, it almost stands just by itself as just a history, as this amazing history lesson for and story of this character. But it's, I think it's in a truly amazing television series. I think that's kind of for me why it stands out so much, because even as great as the series, it still sets it apart because it is so different than everything that comes before or after it.
I would agree with that, because we were debating like the other possible best episode of this series, and yes. I would agree with you.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the only one that could stand alone. Sure. Like, you would have some questions, like you said, about the older woman, like, hey, who's that? But yeah, like, this does definitely function on its own, and like, just the artistry that went into putting this particular episode together. Like, cause I'm trying to think, with the flashback, I didn't watch the first episode. Like, the original flashback, that wasn't in black and white, right?
No.
Okay. Right. No, it was just like really beautifully done. Now, did you catch like the fact when they were originally hanging Will, like that looked a lot like the tree that he used later, that Lewis Gossett's character, not character, but when he was older.
Even though it doesn't make sense now I think about it, I remember at the time I thought it was the same tree, but then I realized,
yeah.
wait, they're in New York and Oklahoma. Right, it can't be the same tree. So did Reeves just look for like the closest approximation to that tree?
Maybe, I don't know, but it felt like the same setup.
Well, if you're asking, would it surprise me if they just use the same tree, like on the show? No, that wouldn't surprise me.
No.
And maybe deliberately.
I like the symmetry of it. I'm not going to ask any questions. Come on.
It's interesting because, again, the series overall is a very, I'll repeat a phrase I used earlier. It's a very visually arresting series. The visuals are really striking all the time. But as far as how the episodes are put together, I mean, I didn't watch the entire series all over again, as I was telling you before we started recording. I watched like the first episodes 5 and 6, and then 9 and 10. I just had limited time. So I said, okay, these are the ones I know I want to focus on. I just watched it a year ago. I can kind of remember everything else, except whether it was an elephant or not.
It was an elephant. It was a snake elephant.
Thank God. Because, you know. one star review coming right up.
Yeah, no, it was a sleeping elephant that was never explained. So,
oh no, I don't mind them explaining, because they keep using elephants as analogies in this anyway. So I'm sure there's some, you know, it's maybe they asked Noah Hawley what they should do. I don't know. big giant pig. but anyway, but in this episode, whereas, you know, other episodes like, oh, that's a really nice way the scene dissolves to the next one. You know, which they do. There's a lot of nice transitions throughout the series. This episode, there's so many nice visual tricks, and you know, and some of them are done, you know, as they say, within the camera. Some of them are clearly not, but throughout the episode, they never take you out of the moment. They're only there to serve as I said, they're just to remind you, like, we're in kind of a memory dreamscape here. So you can have you can do that. You can have this doorway in the middle of the, open up in the middle of the street. You can have things being projected on the wall that, you know, there's all these things throughout the episode. It's so beautifully done. And I'm almost surprised. I mean, this specific episode, I mean, it did win a few Emmys. It won for writing, you know, and it won a couple of different sound-related Emmys. I think sound mixing and sound editing, if I'm not mistaken. I was a little surprised it didn't win. If they give one, they must give a cinematography one for at the Emmys. But for all I know, maybe a different Watchmen episode won. that probably would be what happened. But it's just visually alone. It's the best episode of the series. So that on a technical level is one thing, you know, checking the box. Yeah, the other episode we were talking about, and we can talk a little bit about it because it's such a good episode as well, is A God Walks Into a Bar. it's hard for me. That's almost my favorite episode in a lot of ways, because I love Regina King so much. And even though she's obviously in both episodes, that's really more of a showcase for her.
Yeah.
You know, that conversation in the bar alone is, you know, that's the ticket of admission right there. And then when you go through the whole thing, it's just so, so good. But this one came out ahead. It's close.
Yeah, but I felt like you said, when the God walks into the bar, like, I feel like there was a culmination of something that we did not know we should be expecting.
In the ninth one? In that one?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean eighth one. I'm sorry. Did I say ninth? Wow. I keep thinking of it being a 10-episode season. I realized, oh no, it was only 9 episodes.
I thought it was 10.
Nope. It's not. It's a 9-episode season. They were actually, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, they originally were planning for it to be a 10-episode season. And then they decided to cut it back just to compact the storytelling more.
I'm glad they did that. It was so tight. And like I don't know a show where I've been that satisfied with the way everything just went. Usually I'm one of those people like, oh, I need more. Give me another season. But when they were like, nah, this is the one season, this is all you're getting, I'm like, that's right. That's the right decision.
Right. I think if there had been an additional episode within the season there at some point, it probably would have dealt more with the history behind Lady True, from what I understand. So instead, they just took certain elements of that and incorporated it into other episodes, but they didn't give like a full-fledged episode to her, like say they a god walks into a bar is kind of like the, you could say it's the Angela episode. It's really like the Dr. Manhattan episode. Whereas this one is about Will Reeves. The one before it is really about Looking Glass, Wade, Looking Glass. So you do have some episodes that kind of are more focused on one character than anything else. That would have been hers, but that's where they decided to make the cut. Whatever.
Yeah, and that was fine. I didn't miss her story.
Yeah,
like I feel like what we had was sufficient.
Yeah, the series didn't end with me going, I wish I knew more about her. No, they were able to dribble it in other places enough, and marvelous character. I loved her interactions, especially with Adrian Veidt. They're hysterical.
Oh yeah, she was scary.
Scary, but funny. Very funny.
Yeah.
So, as far as, but that episode, when I was doing the research on it, if someone looks up, you'll notice, I think that episode's actually God Walks Into a Bar, or a bar, is actually ranked slightly higher on IMDb or something. If this countdown was based solely on IMDb, then yeah, I probably would have went with this one. But it's not. So I went, everything else kind of, there was just more leaning towards This Extraordinary Being than God Walks Into a Bar. But it was one of those where if I had made the decision, like, I might put my finger on the scale a little bit, I could have. And I really loved that episode, but I just went, I think as far as just ticking all the boxes, I got to go with This Extraordinary Being. It's just... I just remember talking about it. I mean, both episodes generate conversation, but for different reasons. But I was waiting for the God Walks Into a Bar episode because I knew we were going to get some explanation eventually about everything with her and her past. And I kind of knew Dr. Manhattan was going to show up at some point in some form. And there was a lot of speculation, over the course of a few weeks that, we think it's Cal. It's a Cal.
Oh, you guessed?
I did not. I did not guess.
Okay.
Other people guessed it in front of me, and I was like, why are you saying? Because now you put it in my head, so I can't. And you did it like weeks in advance, so I'll never know if I could have come up with that myself. Because I'm always going to think, because you said it, now it's in my head. Damn you.
Yeah. No, I was completely blindsided and completely delighted. Like, this is so different. Yes. How did this happen?
Of course, I do have a question in the finale when he pops up in the lithium cage, and Agent Blake sees him for the first time there, and former girlfriend to him and whatever way back. There's never any moment of reaction about the fact that it's a different person.
She doesn't have that moment, but it's fine because she saw him become something else anyway.
Yeah, right.
I do wish we had gotten more from her.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's Jean Smart, so, I
love Jean Smart. Always, she's amazing.
Who would have known if you were a child of the 80s or a teen of the 80s
and
you
watched Designing Women?
Disparaging Designing Women. But when you
watch, I was going to say she was the best, but they were all amazing.
When you watch Designing Women, you did not think you were going to get an actress who would have the dramatic chops that she's shown over the last 10 years or so on shows like Fargo, like some of Legion, like this, like a bunch of other things. Was she evil on 24? I feel like she was.
No, she was the president's wife, and she was amazing.
But she was not evil? He was evil, but she was not? Are they both evil?
She was not evil.
She was not evil?
I think she ended up hooking up. Sorry. She ended up hooking up with her security.
Oh, yeah. The eye of the guy, the wall guy. Gotcha.
Yeah. He's the one who's always the security.
Yeah. Okay. The grim guy. But, gotcha. Okay. Exactly. Anyway. But I think at the end of the day, the way I would look at it between the two episodes, again, love God Walks Into a War, but mm-hmm. I think This Extraordinary Being just stayed with me longer.
Agree. Like, you had the, like, just the beautiful scenes, you had the writing, and you made it a period piece. You made it a time frame that we generally don't get to see too much these days, right?
Right. Oh, and yeah. No. It's already my sweet spot, so I'm already going to lean toward that anyway. But you just, and again, I'm watching it again, there were just these different moments that just struck me where I was like, oh, I forgot. I mean, look, and not so much, I don't want to say forgot, but just as like, wow, that's really visually beautiful. Or that's really, you know, like, again, the whole freeze frame thing, way they did the thing with him/her smashing through the storefront window and then Blake talking to her and her eyes. And Regina King has these very interesting eyes, by the way, because there's just something slightly, I don't know how to phrase it without, I don't want to sound stupid here. I don't want to say they're off, but you know what I'm trying to say? There's just, they're not, I can't think of the right word to
put it. She shines.
She's, you know, she is why Leftover season 2 is the best season of Leftovers. Not season 3. Everyone thinks it's season 3. You're wrong.
No, I agree. Season 2 is freaking amazing, and she's a big part of why.
Massive reason why.
I agree. The reason. She is well missed in most of season 3. But she was off doing other things. So.
Well, yeah, she has other things to do. So, yeah. and with this series overall, I would say from the fifth. I mean, again, I think the series, you know, top to bottom is really fantastic. Anyone who listens to this podcast might remember it came in number 2 for me for last year as far as overall series. And that was, it was pretty much just me flipping a coin between this and the final season of Mr. Robot. But somehow again, proving no bias, this episode ranked higher than an episode from Mr. Robot from the final season. So there you go. Proof. Take that, Dan. Anyway. But I was going to say, I would say with this series of, you know, just 9 episodes, from the 5th episode on, it just, from that point on, I think it just started moving up to an even higher level. So episodes 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, because it just is like, wow, this is, it just went from very good to amazing.
Yes.
But this is the one I say stands out. Plus black and white photography, so there's that. So, yeah. I love black and white photography.
So. Yeah, and you can't just cheat with it. Not everybody can do what happened in that episode.
No. So, gosh, is that it? I'm sorry. I feel like I did all that. Sorry.
We could talk way longer.
I know, but it's getting late. So, I guess we should start to wrap things up here, but which means I need to talk about what's going to come up next in the countdown. I think that's the format here. Oh, let's see. So, if you've been listening, actually, if you haven't been listening, countdown so far. Number 20 was an episode of House's Head from season 4. Number 19 was an episode of Dexter, The Getaway, the season 4 finale. Number 18, did that with Court, Firefly, was the episode Out of Gas from its one and only season. Number 17, as I just mentioned, Mr. Robot from the 4th season, 407, Proxy Authentication Required. Number 16 was the 2nd season finale of Hannibal, Mixio Mundo. Number 15, hey, Court, you again, to death. It was an episode of The Good Wife, Hitting the Fan from the 5th season. Number 14 was The X-Files, Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose from season 3. Number 13 was an episode of Justified, Bloody Harlan, which was the season 2 finale. Number 12, BSG, Battlestar Galactica. It was the season 3 finale, Crossroads Part 2. You just listened to number 11, which clearly was the Watchmen. I actually just said the Watchmen. Watchmen, which was the Watchmen. And now the Nine Inch Nails. Anyway, it's a Twin Peaks joke. Anyway, Watchmen, This Extraordinary Being came in, obviously, number 11. Now, I am afraid to use the drum sound effect on my phone because we're currently using it as a hotspot. Ooh, it's at 28%. So I am going to spare you guys the sound effect that we normally would have here that I can never cue up just in time. I could do this. No, it sounds horrible. Forget it. All right. All right, so we are going to be kicking off a new year here, and hopefully a much better year. And we're also kicking off the top 10 greatest TV drama episodes of all time. And you're wondering, Jesus Christ, what is number 10? Number 10 is an episode of Deadwood, Sold Under Sin, the season one finale.
Nice.
I believe, I hope, the plan is that this podcast will be released, I'm going to say January 15th. And again, I believe, I hope, I think the co-host will be some guy a few of you might be familiar with out there. His name is Jack. He does some podcasts, I hear, with his son Jay, or used to. I don't know. anyway, yeah, I'm sure almost everyone knows Jack from Jay and Jack. I talked to him about it several weeks ago. I actually gave him a list of a few different shows. I pick one that you might want to do. I think he picked Deadwood because he thought he wouldn't have to rewatch because he's seen it so many times. Anyway, we'll see if he sticks to his commitment. Jack is supposed to be doing that podcast with me. We will see. We are not going to release that till the 15th because sometime between now, and we're releasing this on New Year's Day, and the 15th, hopefully somewhere in between those two, which I guess would be probably the 8th, hopefully there will be some form of a Best of 2020 podcast being released. I just need to iron out the details as far as who is participating on it, and whether there will be lists other than mine on it. I think that probably I should do that. I feel like I should do that.
That would be very nice of you.
It would be. Hey, they said to me, it's your podcast. It's like, yeah, but you know, you people say that, and then people will say nasty things. No, it probably will. I'll just probably have more lists. That's all. You can have one. Brian and Jamie, you can have one list each. I'm going to have three. I joke, but it's going to be true. Anyway, the question is, will Dan appear on? I don't know. I think he's watched like four shows last year. I don't know. Anyway, he might be on. We'll see.
His list will be easy then.
He'll just be annoying me. So, oh, by the way, last time I mocked him, I found out last time I mocked him on a podcast and I said, oh, he's not going to listen to this anyway because I was doing it about a show he wasn't watching. Then he started watching the show and he listened to the podcast.
Hey, Dan.
So he might have to
Die Hard is a Christmas movie. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll go along with that. You know, if we were having this conversation several years ago, I would have went the other way. Now I've gone in that direction.
Bless you.
Court, is there anything that you feel the urge or desire or want to promote here at this point? You know, since I don't know how much I let you talk in the first place.
I've been very, very busy lately. I've been recording with Susan and Kelly for Geek Girl Soup. And now that we have The Stand on CBS All Access and The Expanse is back, I've been recording with Brad again. So Brad and Court Talk over at purefandom.com. You can also find our stuff on SoundCloud, though, Brad and Court Talk. We give a lot of our feelings about what the first two episodes of The Stand, and the next one comes out very soon. So we'll talk about that one as well. You had some feelings too, didn't you?
Yes, I actually listened to your guys' podcast, which anyone who knows me or doesn't know me should know. That almost never happens. Oh, by the way, when I said that, I totally did a hand gesture in my eyes, my mouth. I totally just became David from Schitt's Creek just now. I was in full squint and my mouth was like to the side. I almost never do that. He's such a great character. Yeah, to be semi-serious, I rarely listen to other podcasts because I just, my life is not one which lends itself to listen to podcasts. I don't commute anywhere. I don't go for drives anywhere. So for me to listen to a podcast, I'd actually have to just sit in my house and listen to it. And it's not the 1930s, and I'm not sitting around the radio listening to Orson Welles here, so it's really hard for me to listen to a podcast, you know. But if I listen to, I have to listen to our podcast. But your guys' podcast, it's almost like the anti-SDVD podcast. It was like 23 minutes long. It's like, oh my God, this is like the dream.
We've come a long way. We used to have, what, 3-hour podcasts? But when we started Peer Fandom, we were like, nope, our recasts are going to be 20 to 30 minutes. So we've mastered that. But we still talk.
Right. Unlike what just happened on this podcast.
That wasn't your fault.
But someone's going to give me shit for it. Anyway, so if you enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you did. I really had high expectations for it. We had a lot of technical difficulties, which delayed our starting to record by, gosh, over an hour and a half, which might have kind of spent our energies a little bit. So I don't know. But if you enjoyed the podcast, you'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and talk about shows like all the ones I just mentioned and whatever the hell else you want to talk about there. You can find this podcast as well as, I guess, the last 50 on Apple Podcasts. You know, it used to be iTunes, whatever. You can find all of our podcasts in, you know, the archive, as they say, at stvdpodcast.podbean.com. And I'm shaking my hand like it's a thermometer or a Polaroid or something. What number is this? This would be 294. Good Lord. You can also find us on Stitcher, but no one ever downloads it there, so why bother even saying it? And finally, you can follow us on Twitter, our handle there, and we are somewhat active from time to time. It's at STVD Podcast, at STVD as in Serious TV Drama. So once again, in 2 weeks' time, we'll get to number 10 on the countdown, and hopefully, we shall see 1 week's time, there will be a Best of 2020 podcast. It just remains to be seen how many lists and how many people are going to be on that podcast. I got a feeling 4 people and probably 17. I'm already in my mind planning some ideas for because I think we're going to be hitting a certain number soon. If we're at 294, that means we're getting near a big number. Mm-hmm. So I have a few ideas. I just have to, and they need to involve certain other people. I just need to find out if they want to do it. So I won't say anything more about it. All I'm going to say, one of my ideas will involve talking about shows that we don't normally talk about. And I'll just leave it at that. So Court, thank you so much for your patience tonight, both before and during recording. Hopefully, I believe there may be at least one other show in the top 10 that you might have an interest in recording.
Yeah, you know, I'm always down.
I can't say what it is.
That's fine.
But I talked to you about it before you shut your
mouth. I know.
Oh, you remember.
I remember. I'm working on it.
Wow, look at you. I was actually just having kind of, just 2 weeks ago, having a semi-argument about that show. Actually, I've had two different arguments about that show online in the last few weeks.
Really?
Which is weird because that show hasn't been on in quite some time.
Yeah.
It's one thing to argue about a show like now, but arguing about a show that's been off the air for some time. And one argument was about a specific episode. Mm-hmm. And the other was just about specific seasons. And All I'm going to say is that, well, they were wrong and I was right, but that's always the case.
Well, it's timeless and ever epic.
Yes. So. Now, I love because we've said nothing to indicate what the show is. So people, now it's another mystery. It's See, you know, he must have been talking about a Damon Lindelof show. Look, another mystery. Anyway. So I'm just going to say goodnight to everyone and Happy New Year, everybody. This is going to be released on New Year's Day. I am not good. Unlike our previous podcast, which ended with me doing an awesome Christmas song, it's the best thing ever on our podcast. I will not be singing Old Lang Syne at the end of this podcast. I'm sorry.
But pretend he did.
But you pretend I did. I was going to download like a royalty-free version and put it at the end. I was like, nah, screw that. So, Court, I don't know if you're prepared because I forgot to mention to you before. But since I'm all tapped out, I'm going to say goodnight to you. Goodnight to everybody out there. And since I don't know how many words I let you get in edgewise during this podcast, I will let you have the last word.
Oh, okay.
You never prepare. I never tell you ahead.
You never tell me ahead of time. I can just say Happy New Year. And again, it's always a pleasure.